President Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Welcome to the show. On this December the 12th, on the West Coast, and already now December the 13th on the East Coast of the United States and in the Central Time Zone. Lots of interesting things happening, interesting but trite at the same time. They're banting now the automotive company bailout. And it's a farce to listen to these people talk about how desperately they want to save jobs when all along these companies don't even belong to anyone who lives in the United States. I've written about it. Other authors have also written about it. David Icke, Fritz Springmeier, Peter Moon, and yet they just keep on keeping on with the propaganda like nothing's wrong. I had an opportunity today to listen to Glenn Beck's radio show. Actually, it's pretty funny, but at the same time, it's very sad. He does this thing called Moron Whatever. Moron football, he does moron history or moron whatever topic you can think. And today he was asking some really simple questions, and the amazing amount of stupidity that our country has degraded to, I don't even know how to say it. As a result of our educational system, is to be admired. Let me say that. If that sounds sarcastic, it's supposed to. Glenn asked, he was calling between two cities, Tampa, Florida, and Atlanta, Georgia. And he calls up fast food stores or maybe convenience stores because they're a little more laid back. And he asked some questions. One of the questions he asked a young lady, I don't remember her name, that doesn't really matter. I think she was from Tampa, though. And he said, in what state is Washington, D.C.? And the girl didn't know the answer, so she asked someone there in the store, and the answer came back, New Hampshire. Well, by now, you're probably rolling on the floor. And then they had to either ring a bell for a correct answer or the buzzer for the wrong answer. And, of course, she got the buzzer. And Glenn said, nope, close, it's Vermont. And this is real radio, folks. This is what talk radio has moved to, the level it has descended to on AM radio. This is a syndicated show, mind you. Now, I'll hand it to Glenn. He can do whatever he wants to do on his show. I crack jokes, and I guess he's probably making a valid point in showing how stupid Americans really are. I can't even remember some of the other questions. Yes, I do. Take that back. One question was, there are 10 people who represent the workforce in the United States of America. 10 people. How many people are working? Well, got every number you can imagine except 10. Because if they are the workforce, folks, they are working. But some said 9, some said 7, 3, I don't know. And it seems that we've lost the ability to think. Forget about discernment here. We can't even tie our shoes if people are answering questions like this in that manner. So then Glenn talked about the bailout. I thought it was quite appropriate to sort of tie those two extreme events together, segue from one to the other. It was smooth, and, you know, I still thought he was, oh, it's more on trivia. That's the name of it today. So while he went from moron trivia to the automotive bailout, I saw really no difference. That said, let's move on to tonight's guest. By the way, I apologize on behalf of the network. For some reason, we got backlogged and the show started late tonight. Not our fault. We were waiting to come on the air. Anyway, tonight's guest is a scientist, a prolific inventor. Those of you who have been listening to my show since its beginnings in 2007 and here on BBS now for more than a year, you're quite aware that he knows a lot about everything he talks about. He's also an author. He is a lecturer and a teacher, and he's a good friend and my co-host on Friday nights on Evident Footprints, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Don. I appreciate it, and it's good to be here as usual.
Tell me something. Well, it's nice to have you. Tell me something, Jim. Did you know the answer to that question, in what state Washington, D.C. is? Be honest now.
Of course I did. It's not in any state. It's in the District of Columbia.
Oh, it's in a state, but it's a state of disrepair. it's in a pathetic state. Let's put it that way. Anyway.
Well, yeah, that's for sure.
I wish I could recall these questions. I had even made a mental note. I'm going to remember this so I can share this with my listening audience. And to tell you the truth, It really doesn't matter, I guess, what the questions were. It was so stupid.
Well, actually, you get a similar flavor for where we stand when you watch Jay Leno's jaywalking sequence, and he starts to ask people just ordinary questions, not even trick questions. You know, like what country is Paris in, and you know, just ordinary things that you think people would know, man alive, the answers are off the wall, just off the wall.
Oh, yeah, I remember
I realized, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. We have a delay here, so we might talk over.
I was going to say, I realized that it's kind of representative of comedy, because when you hear the answers, you just can't help but laugh. But on the other hand, it gives us a real peek into the level of mental acuity that's out there. And I'll tell you, it's they have trouble competing with the intellectual capacity of a mushroom.
Now, I wouldn't put mushrooms down now, Jim. Well, we could go do a whole show on this, actually, but we had something more important to share with the audience, and we have been in a discussion for going on a month now about the spiritual perspective of what's happening in the world and what is happening in the universe. And before we get into this, I want to say that I've had a few requests from some listeners to discuss some issues of the ego. You know, I've talked about the ego. I've talked about the false self, and I've talked about the real self. And, of course, the real self is not the person you see in the mirror, and it's not the person that that's usually addressed by name, and certainly not who we feel we are. on a daily basis with all the control that's going on. And so maybe in a future show, you and I can get into a discussion about that, maybe in a scientific way. I think it would be interesting. What do you say about that?
Oh, you know me. I'm game for anything. It's a fascinating subject matter. And as we have actually touched upon that in the past, to some extent, you know, the ego is really a defense mechanism. And so it's pretty interesting that we're all running around defending something that we're not even familiar with. It becomes kind of funny when you look at the real way that the thing seems to work.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, sure, we can. I don't see why we couldn't do that.
Yeah, I'd like to do that. Of course, I've written back or talked to a few folks and told them, yeah, you know, well, that's something that's definitely part of it. You know, I've talked about it, but it bears repeating because somehow I think someone who doesn't feel that they're an egotistical person doesn't see where the ego plays a role in their everyday existence. And yet it's all these things that we relate to through our sight and through sound. You know, through our hearing, and that in a sense is going to apply to what we're going to talk about tonight. So it would be a good place to move, I think, in the future. That said, before we get into this, I want to mention something. Things sort of hit you in a funny way, and sometimes we piece them together very slowly. Sometimes it takes many years to understand something. And what it really means. You remember when they started this thing with portable telephones? The first phones that they had, which were portable, outside of two-way radios, walkie-talkies and the like, were called mobile phones because they moved. And they worked through a system of either microwave technology or satellite technology. And then all of a sudden, they started calling them cell phones.
Right.
Okay. And there was a commercial on TV tonight. And yesterday, I had a conversation with Ken Adachi about a problem he's having with AT&T. And it's one of these typical billing problems where they changed all his service. He didn't ask for it to be changed. They changed it. This is through a buyout. Another one of these bogus corporate buyouts. And, so he's fighting this whole thing with them. And they ran a commercial I heard this evening, and I wasn't sitting down watching TV. I wanted to see very quickly what they were talking about on the news. And of course I got this commercial, and it's very visual, and they have the earth spinning around, and they have these what they refer to as bars. They say more bars than any other phone. And I started thinking, more bars. Oh, those are the bars that you see on your display showing how strong your signal strength is. But really, right. it's a play on words.
Sure it's, is.
It's the network. It's the bars. It's the cell. It's the cell with the bars. It's
right.
A form of imprisonment.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it's funny that you should bring that up. I'm sure you're familiar with Black's Law Dictionary.
Yes.
I wish I had a copy of it because I was involved with an issue with AT&T also not that long ago. I'll relate it to you momentarily. But the thing that got to me was that their little slogan, "Your world delivered." Now, you know, "delivered" actually has a more ancient meaning.
Mm-hmm.
It has something to do with giving someone up for sacrifice. And I don't remember the literal meaning, but I was really, really tempted to look that up in Black's Law Dictionary and see what the legal meaning of the word delivered is. But anyway, you know, your world delivered has a really negative connotation to it. And I think that the executives in these companies really enjoy sending out messages in the form of advertisements and slogans and what have you that actually contain a glimmer of truth. The way they see things, or the way they intend to make things, or something along those lines.
Maybe they're referring to having one's liver taken out.
Yeah, you're being delivered. Well, that's very possible. But anyway, yeah, with regard to your friend, Ken Anachi, is it? Atachi?
Anachi.
Say again?
Adachi. A-D-A-C-H-I.
Adachi. You know, I went through a similar situation, not only with AT&T, but with a bank that was holding our mortgage in New Jersey. And they were bought out by another bank, and the other bank came along, changed all of the billing, the sequences, the amount, and all kinds of other stuff, and they never bothered to inform anybody. And then when we didn't submit the right amount of money on the right day, because we were still in touch with the old schedule, they tried to foreclose on the mortgage. And it turns out that you can't do that type of thing. It's actually illegal. Now, if you have a contract with an existing outfit and somebody else comes along and buys that company and you're not informed or in any way even consulted on the sale or anything else, then you're not bound to whatever the new company's procedures are.
That's right.
And for the legal standpoint, you are actually bound to the original situation. And so I hope that that's something that could help Ken out. But, I mean, AT&T is becoming a notoriously ruthless and inconsiderate organization. And, you know, it's just a shame that they're not in financial trouble. The problem is that, you know, they're using those bars, and they have a very, very sizable income as a result of it.
Well, that's something that will get resolved. I referred Ken to Carl Pearson, who's been on the show, the attorney from New York. And Carl will jump right on this issue. I can guarantee you that.
A fascinating coincidence that you have an associate named Carl Pearson, because I have a friend named Carl Pearson from Sweden, and he's living in New Jersey. Very interesting.
Yes, it is. And they both know Jim Murray and Don Nikoloff. That's a or one does anyway. Okay. Well, let's see. Last week now we had gone through quite a bit. I don't have your outline in front of me, so I'm not sure where we stopped according to your outline. Do you want to refresh our memories or just sort of segue right into the meat of the material for tonight?
Well, basically where we what we were talking about was the started off talking about the fact that the human structure, you know, which we perceive as just being the body, is essentially a collection of interlocking structures that go higher and higher in the scheme of things. And eventually, when you get to the spiritual part, it's directly connected to the light of the universe, or the Godhead. And once we had made that distinction, the reason that we did that was because we were looking for an intro to talk about light in general, and then light more specifically, and so we covered a lot of information about the nature of light itself, because literally that throws some knowledge out there about our own higher nature and the various aspects of different portions of the electromagnetic spectrum. And we went through a whole host of things regarding that. And then we went on to the physical attributes of light, things like temperature and the pressure of light. And we had talked about the fact that the ancients regarded the pressure of light as the finger of God. And I had touched on the expanding universe and whether or not the phenomenon was really related to this pressure of light situation. And that's about where we stopped, by my reckoning. I think, if I remember correctly, we kind of got off on one of our famous tangents.
Yeah.
At that point.
Well, before we dig into this, I want to stress to the listening audience, and I'm sure you're quite capable of doing that too, we're speaking about light in its true sense. We're not talking about artificial light, per se, and we're not talking about demonic light, which mocks the real light. You know, the character known as Satan basically hides behind a facade of light, and it can take on all the physical characteristics of light as we perceive it coming from the higher realms. And it's not necessarily coming from a high realm. It's a misuse of those laws. And so when we talk about light, we're not practicing Satanism. We're not practicing black magic. We're talking about the reality of the universe. So, Jim, I turn it over to you.
Well, as long as you brought that up, that's actually a pretty good way to start some of the stuff we wanted to talk about today.
Thank you.
And I would like to relate an interesting anecdote that pertains to that very subject, and it's something I experienced myself. I had been involved with some teachers, we'll call them that, who are very much involved with the true nature of light, the spiritual nature of light. And over and above what they were teaching, they were also friends of mine, and they were interested in finding out whether or not I would respond to some of their teachings regarding the elevation of spirit. And so they gave a description of some of these breathing exercises, which essentially are related to the raising of the kundalini. And when the kundalini reaches the base of the brain, apparently the reaction, or at least one of the reactions, because I realize there are many, is the production of this pure light of spirit that we were talking about. And I had two really amazing experiences regarding that while I was doing those kind of exercises. And this goes back a long time, too. It was before I was married. So one of them was before I was married. So that's at least 30 years ago. And then the other was during the course of my marriage when the kids were still young. But the first experience was really amazing. I had been visiting my mother, and I was staying at her house in New Jersey, and I had just gone through an exercise of a kata that I was learning for martial arts, and I had put a lot into it, and it was in the spring, I think, so the weather was nice and the house was warm, and I was a little bit sweated up, and I sat down on the couch in my gi, and was just kind of relaxing, you know, and I wasn't trying to achieve anything. That was the part that was so interesting. And all of a sudden, I felt this sensation rising up my spine, and it was so sexual in nature that the only thing I can relate it to that other people would probably understand is those delicious sensations that you have before a sexual release. The problem is they weren't in the right spot. And these sensations were moving up my back, which was totally foreign to me. I had never experienced anything like that before. But I had read about it, and I had, you know, studied some of the exercises and knew some of the things that could happen. So I immediately suspected that it was related to this Kundalini experience. And as a result of that, I absolutely remained calm and relaxed, and tried to just ignore what was happening, but be aware of it, if you know what I mean. And this, this sensation crept all the way up to the base of my spine. And then the weirdest thing happened. I was trying to, cooperate with it. And so I just closed my eyes and I remained in the same position I was in. And, you know, when your eyes are shut, you perceive some degree of darkness. I wouldn't call it, you know, absolute darkness, especially if there's light in the room. But anyway, it was dark enough. And then I kept my eyes closed. And all of a sudden, when this thing reached the base of the spine, I saw somewhere, and I will just have to say in my mind's eye, because I don't know really where it was, this incredibly brilliant white light. I mean, it was absolutely the purest form of white light. Actually, it was beyond being white. It was almost like a silvery white. It didn't have color in the normal sense, but it was so intense. And I remember trying to figure out how to explain that and also trying to satisfy myself with an adequate description of what I was seeing. And the only thing I could think of was in the old days when I was growing up in the attic, we had these jet black shades that they used to pull down to keep the rooms cool in the summertime. And oftentimes when they get old, they would get little wear holes in them that were like the size of a pinhole or maybe a little larger. And when the sun was exactly in the right spot in the southern sky, the light would come streaming through these tiny little pinholes. And despite the fact that the room was relatively dark, the purity of that sunlight coming through that little hole was an incredible experience. And this is sort of what that looked like. And as a kid, I used to go and put my eye to the hole and stare out at the world through the hole in the shade, which was kind of a strange thing to do, but it was an interesting experience. And when I saw that brilliant light and I remembered that thing with the shade in the attic, my first inclination was to go toward the light and try to look into it, almost as if I expected some huge vista to unfold. And the minute that I tried to consciously try to approach it or do anything to it, poof, just disappeared. And I felt so let down at that point, you know, but then I realized I should have remained passive. I shouldn't have gotten actively involved in whatever it was that was going to happen. So it's my own fault that the effect was dissipated. But that type of light is the kind of light that we're talking about, and it's both within and without, which is the most interesting thing. And the second incident that I wanted to describe regarding that type of light, again, I was working with these same people, that they are part of a religious and esoteric organization. And they had encouraged me to continue with these exercises after I related this incident to them. And to be honest with you, when you get married, a lot of things change. And I didn't find myself being quite as rigorously devoted to this stuff as I had been when I was single, and I didn't have the time, and I didn't have the tranquility. But eventually I started doing them at night, because I always went to bed long after my wife did, especially if I was involved in studying something. And so I was sitting in the living room trying to do some of these exercises, and I realized I was falling asleep. So I said, oh, well, you know, I shouldn't be doing this while I'm that tired anyway, because if you fall asleep, you miss the whole point of various types of meditation. So I packed it in, I went to bed, and I was getting ready to get into bed, got my pajamas on, was sitting on the edge of the bed in a totally dark room, and I just relaxed for a few minutes, and I was thinking about these meditations, and I closed my eyes, and the minute my eyelids closed, there was all this light. It was just unbelievable. I don't know how to explain it. It was almost like the inside of my head was lit up. And it was that same ultra-pure white light that I had experienced previously. But it wasn't in a pinhole anymore. It just seemed to be everywhere. And I was so startled by it that I opened my eyes. And when I opened my eyes, I was in a pitch-dark room. And so I closed them again, and the light was immediately there. And it was the strangest feeling, Don, because the message was that the light was within me. And I don't, to this day, I have no clue what that meant. And I haven't had any more experiences like those two, at least not yet. But the quality of that light and the absolute intensity of it and the feeling of purity that's associated with it, you realize right away you're not talking about the same stuff that comes out of a light bulb.
Well, you're describing exactly the manifestation of truth at the level that we've been trying to bring it out in the past month on all these different shows. That's what one arrives at. Now, there is a term. It's commonly used term amongst the general populace of the earth for that experience that you describe of looking through the pinholes of the shade.
Right.
It's called consciousness.
Well, yeah, but the interesting thing about that is, which side is the true consciousness on?
Well, it doesn't really matter. I meant it to sound like it did. I thought, what could you call that? Well, the average person would call that consciousness. That little bit of light that peeps through that pinhole. In essence, you know, I'm joking in a way, but it's probably an accurate description, isn't it?
Well, I hate to say it, but having experienced that and having talked to so many people about the experience over the years, I would even venture to say that the darkness in the room without the pinhole of light is probably the consciousness that, you know, most people understand as such.
Yeah.
Because the essence of purity and truth in a way that defies all description is what was coming through that in that little beam of light in my mind or in my higher self or wherever it was. And I guarantee you that that's outside the normal realm of everyday experience, at least mm-hmm. for me.
Well, I've had this experience that you're talking about. I'm familiar with the pinholes too, but I'm not saying that I've seen the pinholes. No, I have. I've seen that phenomenon. I've seen cracks, too, not just the pinholes. Sometimes the whole shade gets a hairline crack that traverses from, usually horizontally, from one side to the other of the shade. and it produces rainbows and different size beams of light when it does that. What I wanted to allude to is that I had an experience, and I think I mentioned it on a past show with you back in 1982, where my consciousness was opened up for me, and this event went on for 48 hours. I wished it would stop so that I could sleep, because I would start going to sleep, and even in my dreams I was having this experience. So it was one of these events where your consciousness just opens up. But I saw the light. I with my physical eyes, I saw a different kind of light, which was like a mist. It was like a cloud of energy, kind of like the special effects they used on The Outer Limits, if you remember that TV show.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And they would get these plasma clouds that would move through the laboratories, and it, sometimes they would flash little bolts of lightning, and it was, you know, lots of sound effects in the music track, music score. But I didn't have this music. It was just this pulsating light. I would even say that it was a concentrated mass of photons, if you want to call it that. And I see this energy if I'm doing what they call cloud busting. I never called it that myself, but the Amazing Randy termed that as a bogus trick. It's not a real example, let's say, of a psychic ability or a metaphysical talent. Evidently, he knows what it is, but at the same time, he says that it's phony. where you look at a cloud and you can make the cloud disappear, or you can alter the shape.
Oh, yeah, I've done that. You can bore holes in it. You can change its shape.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
Well, that energy that you sometimes see between your eyes and the cloud is the same kind of energy that was in this room. And and it passed through my body a couple of times. When I first reached out with my hand and touched it, it shocked my whole body, and my body literally flew backwards about 10 feet. And, I mean, I just became airborne. And what I experienced after that was phenomenal. And that's never left me. Any of the sensitivities that I gained out of that experience never left me. So, yes, the light is within you, and that is what we've been teaching. That's what we've been talking about. Now there's a lot more in you too, but you touched upon a few things. That feeling of nirvana, if you want to call it that, or kundalini, some call it samadhi, is often described as a sexual feeling, because it's an overwhelming feeling, and yet to be in the presence of the Creator is like that feeling, and that's why that feeling was given to us when we procreate.
Right.
Okay. So that's now, a metaphysical reason for that.
I'm sorry. I didn't. You're right.
Saying,
there is a delay here.
Yeah, I was saying that's the metaphysical reason for it.
Well, the interesting thing is that later on, I began to see manifestations of that kind of stuff externally with my physical eyes. But I've never seen, I only occasionally see it, you know, under normal circumstances. Once in a while, I'll just see a little bright, squiggly thing that just fleets away. And it seems to be made of that same quality of light. But I'll tell you something that I have done over and over and over again. And I don't know if this is something particular to my own psyche or whether other people have noticed this or not, but I was doing a lot of flying in the last few years, and I noticed that when the plane is above the clouds and the light, the sunlight, is essentially aimed directly at the side of the fuselage, if you put your shade up and you just kind of stare without focusing at the window, there are these billions of little tiny, I don't even know how small they are, they look kind of like sperm cells, and I'm not trying to make a joke out of that, that's exactly what they look like, except they're an absolutely beautiful golden color, and they seem to be associated with the sun. And when it hits the window, you can see them splatter like raindrops do when they hit the windshield, but they don't get destroyed. They just kind of wiggle away into the corners. And I have noticed that phenomenon I don't know how many times. And, you know, I close my eyes to make sure that, you know, my eyes aren't overly tired or something, and I open my eyes again, and they're still right there. And if the guy goes down, if the pilot goes down to a lesser altitude, they disappear. And so I'm not sure what it is, but it's definitely a light energy, and it's actually coming, streaming toward the side of the plane, because you can see the impact when the little things hit the pane of glass. And then once they're grounded on that glass, they almost seem to have an animation of their own. And they actually wiggle away, you know, where they go, I'm not sure. Have you ever seen that phenomenon or anything like that when you're flying?
Yes. Yes, I'm familiar with that.
Well, I'd sure love to know what it is I'm looking at. And, you know, you feel kind of strange, like I'm flying with somebody, I'd like to give them a nudge and say, hey, you see those little golden sperm cells on the window there? You know what kind of a reaction that's going to solicit, so I don't usually say anything. But considering the subject matter of this show, I felt that it's okay to bring it up. But I'm glad that that you've seen something similar. Do you have any idea of what that might be, that phenomenon?
Well, I get the impression that there are several things going on together. Number one, that there are light cells or energy cells, if you want to call it that, photons. There are different manifestations of light in different areas of the atmosphere, as well as on the surface of the Earth. And when you're up above the clouds, you're in a space where things where the energy is different. I'm sure you know. I mean, there's a reason why they fly at a certain altitude with these planes, and it has to do with the jet stream and how much easier it probably is to fly. It enhances everything, communications and everything, being up that high. I get the impression that, you know, they've been spraying chemtrails for a long time, and that some of the manifestations can actually be the accumulation of those particles mixed with the light and the energies, because there are lots of energies going on up there now. This is affecting our weather. It's affecting people's moods. It's affecting our crops. It's creating disease. So up there, you know, the gold could very well be from the gold particles that they put in the chemtrails. They're literally putting gold in that. So
that's a surprise.
Yeah.
And well, again, anyway, those are some pretty amazing phenomenon, and I've always associated those things, you know, with light. Now, what's interesting, too, is that light has a direct effect on the brain when it enters the eyes. And, you know, the most immediate interpretation of that whole phenomenon is, well, sure, you know, it's a mechanism of sight. the light comes in and it activates the little rods and cones and sends enormous bundles of nervous stimulation down the optic nerve, and the brain interprets that as the phenomenon of vision. But over and above that, the pure sources of light, like, for instance, the sun itself, is actually capable of supplying stimulation directly to the brain. It does that to the whole body. The rest of the body is, you know, uses light almost like a plant does when it undergoes photosynthesis. The body uses the energy from the sunlight to create vitamin D in the skin, which is essential for many aspects of human life.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that you have a direct path through the eye into the brain and right past the pineal gland and all these other centers that are definitely associated with consciousness has always intrigued me, because it's a direct pathway. And higher vibratory information can be coming down that pathway as well as the stuff we perceive as normal vision. And the reason that I'm intrigued with this, Don, is because the ancients were aware of some kind of a phenomenon that was conscious elevation in conscious elevating in nature. And these sects, if you want to use that term, popped up all over the world, apparently in a completely isolated manner from one another. And they were referred to later on by the Christian folks who entered those lands as being sun worshippers. But if you dig into it, you know, it isn't just a question of the fact that they were saying, oh yeah, let's worship that big ball of fire in the sky because it makes the crops grow and it gives us light and heat. There was more to it than that.
Mm-hmm.
And these people were obviously tuning in to something in association with the sun that our culture has missed. And I've looked for hints about what that could be. And the most interesting things that I found were actually in the Egyptian Book of the Dead, where the translation, of course, may be a little off, but they talk about the fact that the sun is essentially the eye of God. And that's pretty phenomenal, because it probably doesn't mean the physical sun. It probably means, you know, the force behind the sun. But the interesting thing is that, you know, looking at the sun and bearing that in mind is interesting, because it gives you the impression that you're looking God in the eye, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And under those conditions, it can be an exchange of some sort, just like you and I could never say a word and look each other in the eye, and there would definitely be an exchange of some sort, almost on a subliminal level. I mean,
an understanding, yeah.
Yeah, and you do have an understanding of it. I mean, people do this all the time. And
well,
so there is a force involved with that, which I'm sure is carried by light.
Yeah, the one thing that we might point out here too, Jim, is you've seen this light beside the airplane. I've seen it bouncing off the clouds and going up too, not just hitting the plane. I see it in different intensities, and sometimes it takes on characteristics of a prism, you know, the way a prism would separate the separate colors in the white light, and most people would call it a rainbow because they see the pattern that's in a rainbow when light strikes a prism. It's also quite possible that only those that have the psychic vision can actually perceive that, but we see it so clearly it's like seeing it with your regular eyes. Or it's that because of the psychic sensitivity, the eyes are now able to see it. I can tell you that I'm perfectly conscious, and I've seen that energy. So it wasn't a delusion or a hallucination. I saw it. And now I know that from experience, I could say to someone or ask them, did you see that? And they'll say, see what? Well, look, it's right there, and they don't see it. So it's right. Related to consciousness, too.
Well, Wilhelm Reich touches on that very subject, especially in regard to the waves of orgone, which he was experimenting with. And he used to produce that effect in a darkened room and sit there, and he literally had the room set up very similarly to an orgone accumulator. So he was encouraging the motion of this energy through the room. And if he was to sit there in the dark and just trust his senses, sooner or later, he started to see these kind of purple-colored waves that were spinning around and moving through the room in various ways. And he also claimed that that energy was delivered by sunlight and behaved entirely differently once it was absorbed by matters here on the Earth. So the idea that there's an energy associated with life is a pretty fascinating concept. And, of course, anyone who's familiar with the orgone knows that it's essentially been identified as the life force.
Well, so sure.
When the ancients were worshiping the sun, they weren't that far off. I mean, that's the source of the life force which animates everything on our planet.
Well, one could go on a beach or anywhere out in nature where there are rocks, and let's say they're multicolored rocks. You have some white rocks, some gray rocks, and some black rocks. You can pick up the white rock, and it'll feel somewhat cool to the touch in comparison to picking up, let's say, a black rock or even a darker gray rock. And those darker colored rocks absorb more light. And they give off heat. As a result, they're taking in more energy. So there's something about the color of rocks that enables them to manage transduce. I don't know what they're transducing it into. Other than heat.
Right. Well, that's an amazing accomplishment right there.
Yeah.
Because it represents a huge step down in frequency from, you know, the higher colors of the optical spectrum to the all the way down to one side where you're producing an infrared radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that... Interestingly enough, I mean, we could do a whole show on that because Tesla and Moray and even Keeley, to some extent, all talked about the phenomenon of a gain in energy being associated with a decrease in frequency. And so, you know, the normal light might not feel so hot to you in your hand, but once it gets transduced to a lower frequency, the rock is much hotter than the light that's landing on it.
And yet you could take a magnifying glass, and by holding it at a certain angle, you could set a piece of white paper on fire by focusing the ray coming through the other side of the magnifying glass on that paper. I'm sure you've probably tried that experiment a couple of times.
Oh, yeah, we used to use it to light firecrackers. So I'm well familiar with it.
Yeah.
Well, and that's an interesting way to get to the next subject that I was going to touch on, which is laser light. Now, laser light is apparently not found in nature, or if it is, I don't know where it's encountered. But the interesting thing about it is that unlike ordinary light, which is this huge distribution of frequencies arriving all at one time, and we perceive it as white light, which is actually a terrible description, or sunlight. But the laser is capable of isolating only one frequency from all of that other collage of light, and then being able to focus it with exceptional intensity. Because getting back to the magnifying glass, if you can actually see what's happening there, every frequency of light that's passing through the glass has a different refractive index with respect to that particular medium. Mm-hmm. And so if you could actually see in great detail what's happening at that focal point where that light hits the paper, each one of those colors of light is not on top of the same spot. It may look like it's producing a spot, but it's actually producing a bar. And each frequency is hitting in a different place on that bar. So the focus may seem intense, but it's actually quite blurred. But if you have a fine optical lens and you have only one frequency of coherent light and you pass that through a lens, now the thing is brought to a perfect point of focus. And the energy density that's involved goes right through the roof.
That's a laser, you're saying.
What's that?
That's the principle of a laser, then, is what you're saying.
Well, yeah, it's greatly simplified, of course, but that's nonetheless what happened.
Yeah.
And so the interesting thing there is we find, and I've actually encountered this type of thing in other work that I've done over the years, but it's like the whole mechanism of the laser is essentially a filter which removes all the other frequencies and puts as much energy as possible into only one frequency so that you can have a great deal of control over it and thereby create these laser beams and the signals injected into fiber optic cables, you know, and all this type of thing. Mm-hmm. Well, the interesting thing is that's the equivalent in optics is the equivalent to tuning a detector circuit in a radio. You know, if you have an antenna that's going up somewhere, you're collecting thousands of frequencies on all these different stations around the world and whatnot. That, all that stuff is hitting your antenna at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't listen to all of it. It would just be noise. But by actually using a discriminator circuit, you can tune into one particular frequency, and lo and behold, it's carrying a message.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you something, and you almost answered it. You half answered it. I was going to ask, you know, we know that they can do this with sound, that they can transmit sound through the ether, so to speak, and we talked about that last week. Let's say at a vibration where it doesn't enter the brain through the ears per se, but one hears inside the head as
if
someone was delivering the message. Do you know of any technology from your experience that they're using light to accomplish that purpose?
No, I don't know anything that's using light, but I've heard that they're doing electromagnetically that they're doing that they have a way now of sending a radio beam, or if it isn't radio, it's something akin to it, through the brain tissue itself, and you can actually cause sensory experiences, you know, to manifest so that it gives the impression that you're hearing something or seeing something. But in actuality, it's the result of a direct stimulation of various areas of the cortex by means of electromagnetic radiation. And that's kind of scary because if they ever get a handle on that, you can have a method of inducing hallucinations under the control of, a radio circuit or whatever it is they're using for that purpose.
Cell towers and the HARP system, for example. I felt that they've been doing this for a long time on television screens. And the whole, and likely with computers as well, the aspect of pixelating a picture, breaking it up, creates a pattern, and that pattern can carry a program, and that program does its thing, depending on the frequency desired and the effect that they're trying to get across. Which is why if you notice when you're watching a scary movie, usually the scary things don't happen in the daylight, do they? They happen in dark scenes. They literally come out of the blackness of the images. And,
right.
And that is opposite of what comes from God, which is the whole reason why they use that principle, because everything God would show anyone would come purely through light. Doesn't have to go through darkness. So there's a clue as to where it's coming from when you're watching a horror picture of some sort that's designed to create fear and panic and all the other sensations that go along with it. And yet some people are attracted to that too.
Well, I'm sure it's addictive. It's kind of like an adrenaline rush, you know, like the first time that you really get the tar scared out of you, it might be conceived as a negative experience, but if you do it often enough, it turns into a kind of a high. And there are people that definitely are addicted to adrenaline highs. So it's easy to understand how that's possible. But you know, mm-hmm. You brought up something interesting too, Don, in mentioning that whole mechanism of the dark side of TV. I've noticed something very intriguing that I've wanted to investigate. Did you ever turn your TV channel as you're hunting for something and you come to a totally blank channel and the only thing that's there is the, for lack of a better word, let's just call it the background radiation hiss, and there's nothing, you can't hear anything except white noise, and on
yeah.
the screen... On the screen is the visual manifestation of white noise, which is just like an annoying pattern of tiny little pixels moving all around.
Yeah, well, I've seen that, and I associate that whole description to CNN and Fox News too. But that's another story. But yes, I have seen that. Sometimes in black and white, even on a color set, and then other
yeah.
times in color.
I don't think I've ever seen it in color, but I've definitely seen it in black and white. And the thing that's interesting about that is, and here again, you know, it's one of those subjective things that it's sometimes a little bit difficult to discern whether it's a real thing or not. But if you stare at that pattern long enough, it almost looks like there's things trying to come through. Momentarily, they'll arrange themselves into something that's just about recognizable, and then it'll peter away, and then another thing will appear. And what I've related that to, and I've neglected to mention it in the past because we got off track on it, but remember when you were talking about the manifestations that follow the ether ships around that looks
yes.
like entities trying to come through?
Yes.
You know, from another domain. It
mm-hmm.
seems that the same thing is trying to happen on the TV screen if you get a blank channel like that, because the white noise that's coming through there is essentially representative of the background radiation of space or wherever that signal is being derived from, and it doesn't have any information content other than the random stuff that's picked up in the process of sending the signal. But that doesn't mean it's totally random.
Yeah, that's true. I know exactly what you're talking about. And I've sat there and listened to it and studied it to pick up patterns. And I hear the pattern as well as I see the pattern.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so that's a very weird phenomenon. And I guess, you know, it's a funny thing, but most people just don't think about the details of a lot of this kind of stuff. And it's almost like they deprive themselves of the full spectrum or the full range of experiences that they could have in life. You know, I remember when I started studying all this esoteric stuff in any great depth was when I was in high school. And I went to my dad about it, and I said, listen, you know, I'm really interested in this stuff. And I found an organization that professes to teach this stuff, and I would really like your permission to join. And I think I was 14 or 15 at the time. I don't remember the exact age. And the organization was the Rosicrucians. And my dad gave me permission to join them just to find, you know, so I could find myself or whatever you want to call it. And I didn't stay with them because I felt that they were, after a while, they were just too monetary in the way they did things. But nonetheless, I experienced a lot of really interesting phenomenon that borders on exactly the kind of thing that we were just discussing, where you're not sure just how reliable your own cognizance is. And they did things with flames, and they did things with sound, you know, different types of music and different types of noises, like the tinkling of bells and this type of stuff. And it seems that an awful lot of this opens up into a much bigger vista of information if you pursue it. Yet, how many people are really intrigued, for instance, by a candle, the light of a candle? You know, we light a candle, we don't pay any attention to it, it sits there and burns, or else it's on a birthday cake, and it's just a flame, you know. But there's not only physical and chemical and, you know, esoteric and spiritual aspects to all these things that only become apparent if you delve into it more deeply.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that most people just take it for what it means on the immediate front. Yeah, it's a flame. Who cares? You know, that type of thing. And the same thing with so many different phenomenon that are a universe unto themselves. The mind, it's almost like the average mind is afraid to dig into it and prefers the apparent simplicity of taking it in its immediate form, rather than digging deeper. Have you noticed that about, you know, human nature?
Oh yeah. In fact, I have a candle burning in my studio right now, and throughout this show, I've been watching the flame, and the flame has been utterly still, very quiet. One of the most sedate candle flames I've ever seen. And it brings to mind the little idiosyncrasies of a candle flame, that you can put your finger in the middle of it and not burn yourself, but don't put it up an inch or so above the point of the flame.
Yeah, well, then you'll really catch it.
Yes. So there's a lot to learn from watching it. You ever wonder why the light is multicolored? Why there's near the wick it's blue? And there's a space above the wick and pretty much around the wick, at the top of the wick I'm speaking about, that is a dark color, as if it's absent of light. And then the light reaches out. It's very multidimensional.
Yeah, it really is. And you know what's interesting too, and by the way, the answer to that is that right near the wick is the temperature there is just right for the liberation of whatever fuel you're burning into a gaseous form, which is the reason why that, you know, shows up as a blue color usually. And then the particulate matter that's also carried up on a microscopic level by the convection currents, gets into that heated portion, and that's what gives the flame the incandescent appearance that you see in the orange and in the yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you get to the outside, you say that it almost looks like there's nothing there at all. Well, actually, it goes beyond that. There's like a, there's literally a dead spot. It's it almost defines the outline of the flame. It's hard to see because flames don't just stand still; they flicker.
Yeah.
But if you look at that region, that's where the things are cooling off fast enough and being absorbed by the surrounding air, and it does form an envelope, which is almost a little barrier.
Yeah.
And so it's like there's so many different aspects to all these things. They're all universes unto themselves, Don.
And then the candle has an, or I should say the candle's flame has an aura around it, too.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And that's probably a true aura of a higher,
yeah,
a higher nature. Because
yeah,
there are secondary aspects to every manifestation in the material world, which also branch off into the spiritual. I remember, you know, now that you've brought that up, I remember seeing a diagram once in an esoteric book that showed the true nature of the heart. And it was in the most amazing thing. I don't remember it all because it was quite involved, and it was labeled, you know, with many different titles. But essentially what it showed was at the very bottom of the diagram was the physical heart. And then, you know, there was all these other aspects of the heart in higher and higher octaves of energy until finally at the very top, you know, it was a totally spiritual thing. And
yeah,
everything, you know, if that's true of the heart, that's not the only thing that's like that. I mean, everything is that way.
Yes, absolutely. So, I was going to comment too, Jim, that music and light together and separately have their own capacity to alter human consciousness for the better. If you think about the... Normally, when we think about a flame, we think about something burning. However, the flame can illuminate. The flame can cause other aspects of reality in a universal sense to be manifested. And I know music can do the same thing. Music can be very enlightening. It can heal. It can warm someone, just like a candle flame can warm someone.
Yes, that's very true, and that reminds me of some of the experiments done by Clave Baxter back in the early 70s and 80s, where he was investigating the way plants react to different things. I think we covered that in one of our shows, but anyway.
we did, yes.
The thing that's relevant to your statements is that I think he was one of the first people that put loudspeakers in greenhouses and played various types of music to the plants. And classical music, you know, truly beautiful music, always caused the plants to move toward the sound, and even vines to grow up and wrap around the speakers and this type of thing. And then when they played some of that obnoxious, what do they call it, heavy metal, or, you know, some of the really off-base type of rock and roll, the plants went out of their way to get away from it. And, you know, that definitely sends a message, at least in my mind, you know, that there are both beneficial and harmful aspects to music, depending upon its structure.
Well, I told you about the experiment I did with country music. My plants were gone the next day. And I never did find them. I'm just kidding.
So they got up and left, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Well, Jim, we're out of time. See how fast this hour goes.
Well, I tell you, I can't believe that the hour is gone already because I think I've gotten used to those two-hour shows we were doing, you know. But, wow, it's just gone already. It's amazing.
Well, we can always pick up where we left off. I would like to touch on the ego next week, the true nature of the ego, and in respect to someone discerning. All of this is going to basically congeal into one concept. I've had some discussions over the past week about the ego and about the heart center and about how we have been programmed to accept all the imagery that we're given, and with all the bells and whistles that make it a bit more dramatic, let's say. And I know that when I was learning to recognize the difference between discerning what is in the heart and what is in the mind heart, the artificial heart that's been created through all this imagery, through this programming, I feel it's important because a lot of people are uncomfortable with that concept. They hear the word ego and it's thought of as something negative, or it's a way not to be. And in a sense that's true, yet the way we use words and the way we define things is often very off base and just intended to control us. So the purpose of this discussion would be to liberate those that are unclear, uncertain about what exactly is the ego and what exactly is the heart. Okay?
Sure, and that's a challenging thing there because some of that stuff you can understand intuitively, but it's not necessarily easy to reduce to words. So I'm going to have to do my homework on that one.
Okay, well, I've done mine. So I'm just kidding. We'll definitely be in an interesting discussion. And at the top of the show, and you remind me if I should happen to forget, anything that we haven't covered that you want to cover first, we'll handle that first.
Okay, that's no problem.
Okay, well, Jim, I want to thank you for being on the show again, and also the listening audience for tuning in. Special thanks to Don Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in to the show. Have a wonderful weekend, and have a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.